What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends Podcast, John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And to hear that our next guest really likes our work, John, was really one of the highlights of doing this podcast over the last year and change, because I have such respect for this man. And I'm talking about Joseph A. Califano Jr.
Yeah, well, we know people are listening out there, but it is nice when you get a note.
Well, when you think about his career, I mean, he spent 30 years in Washington, and he served in the Pentagon, on the White House staff. I mean, he was the guy involved in the Great Society with Lyndon Johnson, the head of domestic affairs for him. And the New York Times called him the deputy president for domestic affairs. Wow. That's how powerful he was.
Wow, he was right up there.
And then he was in the cabinet as a U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. He's been an attorney on Wall Street and in Washington. And John, let's play back that clip of what he had to say about America Trends.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, it's great to be here, Larry, and I think America Trends is a great broadcast. I want you to know that my research assistant said I listen to it all the time.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, and he's got me, had me listening to it. So I think it's great, and thanks for having me, and thanks for what you do.
Oh, thank you so much. Joseph A. Califano Jr., our damaged democracy. Well, he is a remarkable man. And John, when I think about it, if there's an analog to him in the more recent past, it would probably be someone like Leon Panetta, who was a chief of staff. He was the head of the CIA. I think he was at the Defense Department. When you think about these reputations among Democrats and Republicans, that these were men who stood above so many in Washington, and their careers spanned so many different decades and administrations.
And they were there for, you know, the good and the bad. I mean, they've seen it. They've really seen it all, I suppose you could say.
Absolutely. And what he is warning us today, as he steps back away from the hurly-burly of today's politics and looks at our democracy, who better to give us an assessment from 30,000 feet than Joseph A. Califano Jr.? The book is called Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. And I know it pains him to see where we are today, but he's got advice about the Congress, about the presidency, the judiciary, and he's somebody that we really need to listen to on this episode of America Trends. With us on the line is Joseph A. Califano Jr. Many of us know him from his many, many years of service to our nation in so many important capacities. His latest book is an important contribution, too. It's called Our Damaged Democracy, We the People Must Act. What is most concerning to you? I know you start the book talking about the imperial presidency. Is that the greatest threat?
Well, I think the three branches of government have lost their constitutional balance. That's part of the threat. And then I think why and the problems relating to that, including money, including the world of, you know, the way our parties are now divided, the partisanship. But I can start with the presidency. I mean, people, the president is now has a colossal amount of power. Think about the fact that for the last 50 years, presidents, Republican and Democrat, have sent literally millions of Americans into combat. A million have been wounded. 100,000 have lost their lives. There's been no declaration of war. I mean, the only place in the world where war is not war is Capitol Hill, where the House and Senate are. Secondly, the president it started with Reagan, this practice. You sign a bill from Congress into law, and in your signing statement you say, I'm not going to obey by this part of it. I'm not going to enforce this part of it. Reagan did it with some environmental thing, but everybody's done it. Every president, Reagan through Obama through Trump, have done that. Thirdly, the president can now is the nation's chief legislator, partly because of that, and partly because he issues, the executive branch issues about 20 regulations for every law that Congress passes. And those regulations obligate you. There are civil penalties, and there can even be criminal penalties for violating them. And the staff, when I was on the Johnson staff in the 60s, and in the Kennedy staff before, it was about 50 people. It maxed out at 50.
That's amazing.
Today, it's around 2,000 with Obama. There's so much turnover with Trump. I don't know, but you know, Larry, think about this: the White House, the president, operates a state-run media. We have WhiteHouse.gov. We have YouTube around the clock. We have internet around the clock. We have interactive internet. That's the kind of thing that we used to talk about in the context of Soviet Russia or a monarchy. And there are a few hundred people that do nothing but run that White House operation. That's a fantastic communication.
Well, we also had a gentleman on, Mark Perry, talking about what he saw as a divide between the National Security Advisor within the White House and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Pentagon, that in fact now there's a whole nerve center right within the White House that did not exist for a long period of time.
That's right. I mean, I think John Kennedy probably, when he put McGeorge Bundy as, you know, gave the National Security Council and the National Security Advisor some prestige. But, you know, in the Kennedy and Johnson years, the National Security Council was, I would guess, 10, 12, maybe occasionally 15 people. You know, today, it's over 400 people. Now, think about that. Over 400 people sitting over the State and Defense Departments. We have a Secretary of State who has virtually no one under him as his appointee. Mattis is tough, and he's got a lot of connections in the military, obviously, at the Defense Department. But still, a lot of those jobs remain unfilled. Well, we know where they're being run. They're being run out of the White House. I had a domestic policy staff of four people.
And that's when you were rebuilding the entire domestic policy that we still live with in America today, the Great Society.
Yeah, and now the staff is somewhere between 200 and 300. It's hard to tell. And you're right. And yeah, think about that. That's exactly right. Now, we had a president who knew what he was doing, had enormous focus. You know, he knew he wanted to do civil rights. He knew he wanted to do poverty. He knew exactly what he wanted to do from 30 years of public service. And lastly, and my other example would be, you know, you raised the foreign policy issue or what have you. But think about this. And when Obama went into Libya, he said to Eric Holder, are these hostilities that I have to report to the Congress or pull the troops out? And Eric Holder sent him an opinion that said they are hostilities, you have to report to the Congress or pull the troops out. So what did he do? He turned to the White House counsel. He asked him the same question. White House counsel said they're not hostilities. And Obama followed the White House counsel. I'm not blaming Obama. My point is that every president and the White House counsel's office for LBJ was, you know, Harry McPherson and Larry Temple and Lee White, and no more than one or two at a time. And now, what is it, 30 people? I don't even have any idea. It's very hard to get numbers. It demeans the Justice Department.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All so right. Well, that sure dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. We're the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
When we do look at the concerns that you're raising, of course, Donald Trump is suggesting that we do need to take some of the regulations off the books. Now, of course, you were involved in many Democratic administrations. Do you feel that we have given way too much authority outside of the bounds of the legislation that underpins a lot of this regulatory environment? Have we just gone way over what is necessary? What are you thinking?
I think we're seeing how erratic life can be when the president has the power to issue all these regulations, and then another president comes along and changes them. And then Trump comes along and repeals a lot of them, which incidentally is really putting in effect a new regulation. When you repeal certain environmental limits or what have you, you're really creating another regulation de facto. And I think, let me go back to Johnson. This is when I was in the White House, we passed the Civil Rights Act of 64, then the Voting Rights Act, but there was enormous pressure from the civil rights movement and from the labor movement for fair housing. And they said, issue an executive order. The president can do it with his pen. And John Kennedy had said you could do it with your pen. He didn't, and pressure was on Johnson. And I said to the president one night, you can issue an executive order. And he said, I can issue an executive order, and the next president can repeal it. This is going to be very controversial. We have to get a law. Well, we did. It took us 3 years, and sadly, it was King's assassination in order to get Congress to finally pass a Fair Housing Act. It's still on the books. It was probably the most unpopular civil rights law we passed. But so that's it is important, you know, to get the Congress to buy in. And the Congress is another problem.
Well, let's go to the Congress, because in part two of your book, Our Damaged Democracy, The Crippled Congress, and you start talking about the grip of the gerrymander. We did an entire episode with Dave Daly from Fair Vote about the gerrymander. But why is that the lead in your concern and your section on Congress?
Because, one, the gerrymander devalues the votes of people. Just the way when we didn't have one man, one vote, and an urban vote could be worth 350, a suburban vote, a rural vote could be worth 350 urban votes. The gerrymander devalues the vote, but it does something else that's very troubling. Once the district is safe, the battle is in the primary. And the primaries of the Republican and Democratic parties are often pressure points where the fringe of the party, the right wing of the party or the left wing of the party, becomes the powerful point. They get elected, and they are in a position, the person elected, the congressman, can't compromise. I can't compromise. It makes compromise much more difficult in Congress. I think it's a major factor in the failure of Congress to compromise on these issues. My God. We couldn't have passed the Great Society without all kinds of compromises. And that's compromise is now a four-letter word in Washington.
and the hollowing out of the political center. When I look at my own history politically, and I look at the Trumans and the Kennedys and the Eisenhowers, I mean, I look back to those periods longingly looking for a centrist. What has happened to the center?
I think that's part of it. I think money is part of it in a couple of significant ways. Money, first of all, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, people that can contribute millions of dollars. They want something, you know. They're not doing it for nothing. And the single issue part of the world, political world we now live in. So a billionaire can say, okay, I'm opposed to marijuana legalization. If you just stay with that, I'll fund you right through all the primaries. Or I'm pro-choice, or I'm pro-life, or I'm for gun control. I'm against, but that's the only issue I care about. You have to stay on that issue. So the single issue, money issues, have created candidates that literally care about one single issue. And that's what they were elected on, and they're just not going to give on that issue. I think these things feed into each other. You know, they make it more difficult. And when you talk about the center, I mean, when I went to work for Lyndon Johnson, he said, you treat Everett Dirksen, the Republican minority leader, the same way you treat Mike Mansfield, the Senate majority leader. You treat Jerry Ford, the Republican House leader, the same way you treat the Speaker of the House, John McCormick. That's the way we did it. That's unheard of today.
Absolutely. When we look at your section, Congressional Chaos, I think we just did a podcast on China and talking about young Chinese and young Americans, and we all come back to the fact that many people overseas don't even look at America as well-functioning any longer. We always thought that we could take that for granted, that we were the best-functioning country, even with all the turmoil and all of the conflict that always is part of the political process, that we would be a get-things-done. But today it feels like we've really lost our way. And how long can we stay out here in this state of chaos?
Well, I don't think we can, I think. And it is chaotic. And just, I mean, just think about this thing between Nunez and Schiff. So Nunez writes a memorandum. He gives it to the White House, which gives it to the FBI, which gets it back and gives it out. And then Schiff writes a memorandum. He gives it. Come on, these two guys. And now they put up a wall between their staffs. You mean they can't talk to each other? It's a parody. Imagine if you're in China and looking at that. I mean, you're saying, that's the House Intelligence Committee? You know, it's easy. No wonder we can hack into you guys. No wonder we can meddle with your elections. It's very troublesome. And I mean, you know, there are it is also a pay to play Congress we have up there. There's an appendix in the book of every Democrat in 2013 in the House of Representatives, and how much money they were required to raise for the House committee, the Democratic Party in the House, not themselves. And if you want to chair a big-time committee like the House Ways and Means Committee, which does taxes and banking and stuff like that, or the Defense Committee, you're talking about $500,000. So you have to pay. You have to commit. They call them party dues. And the Republicans have the same thing. I wasn't able to get somebody, Republican, to leak something like that to us. But you know, actually, the Republicans charge $800,000.
Yeah, sure, it's higher.
They do.
But what about the notion, not only that, I mean, that's bad enough, but that 50% of their time is spent across the street raising money and not legislating, and then they go home early, as you talk about. They don't really fraternize with each other. There isn't that sense of camaraderie. So they are really, really isolated beings within that body.
Isolated, that's a perfect word, isolated. That is exactly what they are. That they are. They go across the street because, you know, as you and I know, you can't raise money on federal property. So you run across the street. They even send out memos to their freshman members when they come in. You know, you have to spend, they call it call time. You have to spend 4 hours a day of call time. And call time is to get on the phone and raise money. And then, yes, they either go to the districts or, incidentally, they come to New York, they come to Chicago, they go to Los Angeles, they go to San Francisco, they go to Dallas.
Or we're in Connecticut, of course, Greenwich or a place like that, yeah.
Absolutely, and there, and you know, that's where the money is. You know, why do they go there? You know, like the great bank robber, you know, why do I rob banks? That's because the money is there. And they become more responsive to their committee special interests. If you're on the transportation committee, you're likely to be a little more responsible to the truckers than to the constituents in your district, because money is so important to you that you want to make sure you don't offend the truckers, even if you may have to take a little hit from some of the people in your district. This is and you know, that's not a democratic government, and that is deeply troubling.
Joseph Califano Jr. is with us. Our damaged democracy, we the people must act. We've talked about two of the branches of government, the presidency and the power it has amassed, the crippled Congress. Let's go to the politicized court. Has it always been kind of a partisan court or no?
No, it's not always been partisan. There's no question that there have been politics in the Supreme Court from the very beginning. But Roosevelt had problems with the New Deal. But remember, when Roosevelt was able to get the Commerce Clause interpreted by the court, he had Republican appointees as well as Democratic appointees with him. Over the past 10 years, in 50 cases, the Supreme Court members have voted the four Republicans party line, the four Democrats party line, and Anthony Kennedy split the difference. So, yes, and what's happened? When the president has to name somebody an appointee to the court, the first thing he wants to do is make sure that that person will vote the way he wants. Today, we appoint, presidents do, they'd rather get appellate judges, so they've seen a lot of opinions, so they know exactly how they think. And, you know, then you pick your man, as Trump did. Trump was only doing what had been done before him, and then the whole political process ensues, where we go through, you know, sort of a theater. I call it a theater of the absurd, actually, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, where everybody acts as though they don't know how the appointee's going to vote, and then they ask a lot of questions, and the appointee, if he's smart, like the most recent one, works his way over these hot coals and gets on the court. And it shows in the votes. And you have also the judges. The one thing that is really new is the way they speak. The two examples are Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Scalia. I mean, on their various sides, there's no question where they stand, you know. And justices didn't used to do that. So when you're arguing, you know, well, if I say this, I've got Scalia. If I say that, I've got Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, this is not the way the court should work, and it filters down. You know, federal district courts, think about this. If you want to block Obama's creation of DAPA, okay, where do you go? You go to the Eastern District of Texas, where the case was assigned to a judge that had come out against it publicly, and issues a nationwide injunction. Then if you want to block Trump's immigration plan, where do you go? Well, you go to Bill Orrick in San Francisco.
The Ninth District, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in which a Democratic, big Democratic contributor, big Democrat, and he issues an injunction. And then we wonder, why do people say the way people look at the Supreme Court has changed dramatically in the last 20 years. High disregard, high sense that people are voting their personal political interests and beliefs, And that is not the way it should be.
Well, Joe Califano, what do we do? I mean, if in fact all of these fissures are evident in our culture, in our politics, you say that really, because you devote an entire part to money, the root of political evil. So let's go there. How do we begin to root the root of evil out of our system? Because everybody says, well, you know, the First Amendment, we have to protect it, and speech is money, so on and so forth. You have McCain-Feingold, then you have all the challenges of these politicized courts. How do we begin to deconstruct this?
One, Larry, I think we do put the case together to get the Supreme Court to reverse a whole series of decisions which say that money is speech. You know, I think there's now enough evidence, and I think the case can be made. It's probably the number one of the top two or three cases that a civil rights lawyer should put together and take to the Supreme Court and try and get them to reverse that decision. Now, after they do that, there's still plenty of problem because we got to get Congress to pass laws that will regulate the use of funds, and I think some kind of public financing is essential. You know, in New York City, for example, at least at the lowest level, for modest contributions, the city will match them. We have to be able to do some things like that. If we don't get the money out of our system, the Congress is going to be owned. It's going to be a billionaire's Congress. I mean, think of Hillary Clinton, and this last election spent what, $7 billion was raised, not just for presidents but for the other federal offices. I mean, my God, and it does diminish the vote. It is a violation of equal protection, but I think now we have vivid examples of that. That's what I. That's one thing I would do. The other piece is to just, you know, believe it or not, I am convinced as a lawyer that courts read newspapers, courts read editorials, courts are sensitive if they have a sense of what the people want. I mean, I thought Obama brilliantly laid the groundwork for his health care plan, which turned the Chief Justice around to this very, you know, arcane interpretation of tax laws to hold that law okay. I think Obama understood that. I think other presidents have understood it. And I think we have to keep the pressure on. It's very important.
Well, how do we do that? Because at the end of your book, you want to be hopeful after telling us that we've got incredible fault lines, that we've got really disrupted institutions of government. But then you say, we the people must act. And what does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, the first thing we ought to do is look in the mirror as voters. You got to vote in the primary. Let's be realistic. All you do is look at the presidential the last time. You know, people say, well, my God, what a pair of candidates. We had a Democratic candidate, Hillary Clinton. She became the candidate with 8% of registered Democrats. Trump became the Republican candidate with 7% of registered Republicans. People complain, well, you know, we had this egomaniac on the Republican side, and we had somebody who was kind of entitled and didn't really offer a program on the Democrat. Well, that happened because people weren't engaged. We have to get engaged in the primary. That is a critical piece here. I think also we have to get involved in one piece I have to lay out, if you give me a second, is the whole racial issue between the parties, because it's dramatic now. At the Democratic Convention in 2016, the delegates were 50% white, 25% African-American, 15% Latino. At the Republican Convention, they were 94% white, less than 1% black, and 5% Latino. Now, we that is a real fault line in America. Mm. And we have to get the part, we have, you know, as I say, as a Democrat, I want the Republicans to get more African-American votes. I think it's important. I think we've got to, we don't want racially different parties. And we don't want parties on the fringe. You know, we don't, you know, this is, probably will rub raw with some of your listeners, but think about this. I was the counsel of the Democratic Party in 1972 when you had the revolution, McGovern, and what have you. There was a, McGovernites supported getting to the floor a plank which would basically have supported legalization of abortion, I think was the way the issue was characterized then. But as it got close to getting, and they had run on that, as it got close to getting to the floor, you know, people even like Shirley MacLaine got on the floor and said, we shouldn't pass this, we should vote against it, because we can't get elected if we don't, if we get too far out on this. And so they didn't. That doesn't happen anymore. When you look at those party platforms, they're written closer to the fringe. Now, maybe they're irrelevant, but they do signal the people that are the delegates. Now, you know, they're listening to this broadcast we're doing. Think about it. There are hundreds of people who would be great delegates. They never thought about trying. Why not? It's a hell of a great week. You can enjoy it, but you can also, you know, say, look, wait a minute. We have to figure out how to get things done, how to clean things up, how to straighten things out.
Well, maybe this infusion of new talent.
Third party.
Right.
Yeah,
well, the infusion of new talent that seems to be coming into the political process may give us some glimpse into a better future. But I want to thank you for, again, entering the arena of ideas and lending your sensible voice to our fractured, damaged democracy. And what an honor to have you on America Trends today.
Well, it's great to be here, Larry, and I think America Trends is a great broadcast. I want you to know that my research assistant said I listen to it all the time.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, and he's got me, had me listening to it. So I think it's great, and thanks for having me, and thanks for what you do.
Oh, thank you so much. Joseph A. Califano, Jr., Our Damaged Democracy.